Welcome to River Life Podcasts. We're a church family embracing the Father's presence, releasing empowered people to declare and demonstrate Christ's kingdom. We trust that God would use what you hear today to bless and grow you so that you would be a blessing to those around you. For more information about River Life Baptist Church, go to riverlifechurch.org.au or find us on social media.
Mark's whole gospel seems to be targeted around asking the reader the question, who do you personally say Jesus is?
Mm.
So we see on the mouth of so many people in so many scenes, this confusion or question about the identity of Christ, ultimately expressed most succinctly by a Gentile, the centurion.
Yep.
Surely this man is the Son of God. But it leaves us with the question, who do you say Jesus is? Welcome to another episode of River Life's Bible Streams podcast. We are in a series on the Gospels, and today we are going to jump straight into the first of the Gospels. But before we get into that, of course, I should say my name is Joe, and it's great to have you with us. I am joined once again by my esteemed colleague, Alex Walker.
Good afternoon. That's such a weird introduction. You have to say esteemed every time.
Well, it's because you are. I esteem you greatly.
Thank you so much.
Currently learning and exploring being an academic in ancient history.
Yeah, that's right.
Studies of religion.
Yes.
Yes. So.
Old Testament is the nice sweet spot.
So. Oh, there you go. Well, we're going to go ancient, but not quite that ancient.
Yeah.
We're going to jump into the Gospel of Mark today. In our opinion, the first written of the four Gospel accounts that are in the New Testament. How are you, Alex, before we get into...
I'm wonderful, thank you.
We're human beings. We should remember that.
We should. I had a wonderful morning reading about Mark and some other methods on historical discourse of religion and stuff like that. I've had a very overwhelming but productive morning.
I bet. And so as we begin our discussion, Mark, what in our historical studies of religion, are we being way too postmodern in how we approach Mark? Or
do we not.
Are we being way too fundamentalist and actually believing that Mark was written by a guy called Mark about a real person called Jesus?
I don't know, man. You got to walk that tightrope.
Are we being naive and thinking that Jesus was really a guy? Well, if you listen to last episode with Mike Bird, you know that, of course, it's all good. We know how to inquire about the historical Jesus. And great to have Mike on. It was very gracious of him to give us that time. And
absolutely amazing episode.
Yeah, he's awesome. Such a great, great guy.
And great, we'll get great books as well. Got to read them if you haven't,
Indeed. In fact, I was just sharing with Alex, I have indulged a little into the Zondervan, the publisher, has a... an online library of video teaching and Mike Bird's work with N.T. Wright. They filmed videos on all of the content and it's all up there, 50-something videos all online. So,
well worth it.
Sadly, not a sponsored plug. If anyone from Zondervan is listening,
fingers crossed,
we will keep mentioning it if you want to give me a free subscription. But as yet, no subscriptions are forthcoming. We are not against... publishers letting us know how we can best support them. But moving right along, sorry, just, I don't know why. My ABC radio roots, I feel
just coming straight out.
Uncomfortable asking and soliciting external support. But anyway, this is no cash for comments going on. We are going to talk about the Gospel of Mark. So I'm going to throw something to you that you're not ready for.
I'm ready
in
now.
In one sentence, give me an overview of Mark.
All right, I'm going to turn this back around.
Ooh.
Mark is the one sentence overview for the life of Jesus.
Boom.
You know what I mean?
I know.
Kind of.
That's great.
Because it's not obviously not one sentence, but compared to your other Gospels and even Acts as well, it's definitely your one-stop shop for learning about the life of Jesus and the ministry of Jesus.
Okay, Okay, so as we jump into Mark's gospel, before we jump into the text of the gospel, it's very helpful to do introductory issues to kind of give you, as you're listening and preparing yourself to read the gospel of Mark, some kind of background help to understand who it was written by, when it was written, why it was written, some of the big themes and stuff that comes out. And even we will give you a bit of an overview of the structure of Mark's gospel so that as you're reading, you can kind of find where you're at. Because as I've been reading through it myself, I'm reading through it with my life group, knowing kind of the section you find yourself in helps you understand why maybe he spends a lot of time on one topic or one story or one thing. But anyway, Mark, written by a guy called Mark.
Yes.
And if not Mark, by another guy of the same name.
Called Mark, yes. Of Mark.
Mark, yeah. Yes. In the Greek New Testament, it starts with simply according to Mark. Kata Markon. So the gospel according to Mark. Who is Mark?
So Mark, we believe, is John Mark, who is referred to as John Mark in Acts.
Not the guy from Seattle who wrote the book about Harry.
Yes, and neither John Mark McMillan either.
Songwriter who wrote How He Loves, yeah. No. I see it was written by Mark, but another guy.
Another Mark. There you go. The John Mark of the Bible. Mark was not an original apostle or disciple of Jesus. It's unlikely he ever knew Jesus in person, but not impossible, perhaps. He is referred to in church tradition and by an early church historian, Papias, as one of Peter's interpreters. So he did have that connection to Jesus, and it's led some people to say that this is really Peter's gospel in that Mark still wrote it, but it's somewhat through Peter's eyes. But we still see that that's a little bit disputed. Other things we know about Mark, Barnabas was likely his cousin.
Yes, yeah. He's the Mark that is famous in Acts for being the dispute
Between
Paul and Barnabas.
Paul and Barnabas.
Paul basically seemed to say, this guy's no good. I'm not working with him. And if you're going to be on his side, we're not on the same side anymore.
John and Barnabas just turn away and leave.
It's in Acts 12. Let me quickly find it because it's the beautiful understatement of Scripture.
It's pretty funny.
if you found this, I'm pretty sure it's Acts 12 where Mark is mentioned first.
I think Acts 13 also.
So here it is. It's in Acts 15. It says, after some days, verse 36, after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, let us return and visit the brothers in every city where we proclaim the word of the Lord and see how they are. Now, Barnabas wanted to take with them John called Mark, but Paul thought best not to take with them one who had withdrawn from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with them to the work. And there rose a sharp disagreement. So they separated from each other. Barnabas took Mark with him and sailed away to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed.
I love how Luke's so diplomatic in his presentation of the events.
Sharp disagreement. I can imagine there's a lot of shouting in Aramaic. I don't like this guy. He's useless. He left us.
Luckily, there is a happy ending, most people believe, because I think it's at the end of Acts when Paul asks for John and says that he's a good resource for ministry. So
that is true.
There is an element of reconciliation at the end of the story, luckily for John, who gets Paul's sting. But that's another thing we know about John, is that he did travel with Paul and with Barnabas on their first missionary journey. Mm. So one of the problems that the early church might have encountered was that apostolic authority was so important. So Mark being the author of this gospel might have been a problem since he was an apostle. But having experience with Paul and also with Peter definitely plays the ball into his court a bit.
So the question I have then, this is the question that comes up. There is a young man mentioned in Mark's gospel, which is traditionally held to be Mark. There's this weird incident, which is only recorded in Mark's gospel in chapter 14. At the scene in the Garden of Gethsemane where Jesus is arrested, there's the moment where Peter, classic Peter, cuts off the ear of the high priest's servant.
Classic Peter.
Yep, classic Peter, which is another indication of Petrine origin, authorship, or at least, you know.
Influence.
Commission, but it says in verse 51, a young man followed him, this is Jesus, as they're fleeing, a young man followed him with nothing but a linen cloth about his body. And they seized him, but he left the linen cloth and ran away naked.
could it be Mark?
And historically, that's been attributed to Mark inserting himself into the story.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, again, not overly flattering. Well, maybe flattering. It's hard to say.
You don't know, yeah.
No adjectives described him. But anyway, so there's this allusion to a young man who could possibly be John Mark in there. There is, historically, from the early church writers, so Papias and others, Eusebius recording all of this in the 3rd century, that there was a desire that Mark caught the core events of Jesus's life and didn't forget anything. And so that's why we get this very unique presentation of Jesus's life, which one of the kind of markers of this is that there's a lot of action and not a lot of description. There's a lot of events, but very little teaching, which we'll come to in a little while. But when do we think it was written? There's a lot of discussion about this.
There's
in the three books I read, they all contradicted each other or all gave so many options that no one came down on any side.
Which is the reality for most dating.
Yeah.
So we've got quite a wide range if you take into account all sort of ends of the scholarly spectrum of roughly as early as 40, even earlier.
Mid-40s,
AD,
yeah,
all the way up to 75 AD is the latest I've seen. I know you like the very early dates.
I'm an early Mark person. I support that, I think. As we talked about in our first episode on the Gospels. But yeah,
exactly. And I'm pretty similar. Like, I wouldn't go anywhere near as late as 75 AD, but I'd accept something even up to the mid-60s as well. Mm. But the important fact in all of it is that it's likely the first written of all the Gospels.
Yeah.
So it's the earliest written
but
within that time.
It does seem to suggest, as we read through all of the Gospels, it's not the first written accounts of Jesus' life. It's just the first overall what we would now call a gospel, which, again, if you have questions what that is, listen to the first episode of this series. But a few factors that are involved with that. So if you take an early dating of Mark, then it predates probably Nero's reign, which was around 63 AD. And Nero, there's massive persecution of Christians in Rome when he was emperor, the horrific stories of being thrown to lions, being used as human torches at garden parties.
Mm.
When there was riots in Rome, Nero tended to blame the Christians because they're an easy scapegoat because they brought this new teaching in. And so there doesn't seem to be necessarily an apologetic for persecution, but this could be seen as something to use to encourage those who are being persecuted. There's mention of in the Passion narrative, so in the crucifixion week, when Simon of Cyrene is mentioned in Mark's gospel, he says that he is the father of Alexander and Rufus, which is only in Mark's gospel.
Yep.
And Paul talks about a Rufus in Rome. If there's a connection, then maybe this is written quite early in that, you know, within a generation, within those first few decades of Jesus's crucifixion, because they were alive and leaders in the Church of Rome at the time. Which also kind of throws into who is receiving Mark's gospel. So if we take it as an early-ish spot, there's a few pieces of evidence for that.
Yep. And just before we move on to the audience as well, a couple of other things that help in early dating is some of the events of the late 60s and early 70s were pretty significant in terms of the Roman landscape. So you probably would have expected Mark to address them in some way or to be influenced by them. So you've got all the political upheaval in the late 60s. You had the year of four emperors, the Roman cycle through leaders like nothing else at the end of that decade. And then you've also got the siege of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD, which if it was after 70 AD, like some people suggest, you'd definitely expect to see a mention of that. Or even if it was written just before, they would have been seeing the warning signs of war between the Jews and the Romans, and you would have expected some prediction. You do get the fig tree narrative a little bit with the doom of the temple, but you'd expect
not as
a bit
explicit
more
as Matthew's gospel.
Exactly. Which is also, I guess, the themes of Matthew being a bit more about kingship and sovereignty play into that a bit more than the themes of Mark. But at the very least, you'd expect to see a bit more on that if Mark was written later than 60 AD.
Yeah, and so that plays into kind of the recipients, because if we're writing in an early point, we're probably writing to, you know, the first generation or second generation of Christians to encourage them, to give them a clarity around the narrative of who Jesus was and is. But the question comes down to, is he writing from Israel, Palestine, you know, kind of that Levant area, or is he writing in Rome? Has he gone with Peter or Paul to Rome, as, you know, as we've heard earlier?
Yeah.
And so if he's writing at home, who's he writing to? If he's writing in Rome, then that changes who the audience is. So there's a few indicators probably in the text that help us start to clarify who might be the recipients.
Yeah, so there's definitely evidence to the tract that he was writing from Rome. There's mention, I think, in 1 Peter, can't remember the chapter, that John is staying with Peter in Rome. And we know that Peter was in Rome for a time. So John being Peter's interpreter, so to say, it's likely that they're in the city together for a bit. And definitely from that and a lot of the rest of the book, an audience of Roman Christians has definitely been suggested. And there's themes that run very anti-Roman, which would explain for a Christian living a countercultural life in the Roman Empire, very anti-Roman and like the flip side of everything that Romans valued, being portrayed in Mark is a big factor into why that would be a pretty ideal audience.
Yeah. Another reason why it's probably not a Jewish audience is that there's no genealogy.
No genealogy.
To note, which plays into some of the themes. If we pick up Jesus' servant leadership, then slaves don't have
genealogies. Yep, it's not important history. Where they came from.
Exactly right. So that plays into, again, a Roman audience, also a thematic idea. There's a few things in the text. So Mark uses some more Roman customs than Jewish customs. So he uses Roman timekeeping. Interesting. I learned that as I was reviewing. The four watches of the night are not three, which the Jews had. So I thought, oh, that's cool. Every day is a school day. It does, interestingly, almost counter to what you said earlier, but I think actually complementary if you step back, is that there's a certain level of positive depiction of Roman individuals. So the centurion actually
is one of the few
who actually acknowledges who Jesus is, which is a massive deal.
Especially since the disciples failed to do so for a lot of it.
Exactly. And so it's unusual for a sympathetic Jewish audience to have a Gentile having the revelation of God when the Jewish disciples didn't. That's problematic at best.
Yeah.
There's also in counterpoint to the Roman practices, which kind of was quite confronting to, it does play down the political aspirations of Jesus, which for Christians under persecution in Rome, this would have helped make them more acceptable to the wider community. So the what's commonly recalled the messianic secret, where Jesus seems to be saying, hey, don't tell people who I am. There's this inbreaking kingdom of God, but Jesus almost downplaying his role as the new king.
Yeah.
And so there's seemingly some space for diffusing the fight around, is Jesus trying to take over from Caesar? Not that he isn't the new king and lord, he's the king of kings and lord of lords, but changing the conversation from political to spiritual, from a political kingdom to God's kingdom breaking in, which comes through very clearly in Mark, even from the very first chapter.
Yep. Mm. Yeah, which is like we were talking about before, for the Romans, political triumph and making their mark on the world was the huge factors of their empire. Wherever they went, they built roads out there to ensure that it was their territory, and they put their own governors in charge of regions while letting them remain autonomous to leave their mark on the world in a political way. So yes, a lot of the Mark servanthood themes of Jesus really undercuts the political ideals of the Romans. And so an audience of Roman Christians reading this and seeing even Peter go, oh, you're the Messiah, but then perhaps misinterpreting what that meant, only for a Roman centurion to pick up and go and be like the first one in the book perhaps to really realize the meaning of the servant, the suffering servant Messiah. That's big for a Roman Christian audience to encounter that.
Which kind of probably plays into the purpose as well, because of the audience and the purpose, I think, intimately connected. If Mark is trying to portray Christians as good citizens of wherever they are, as people who can contribute to the well-being of the community, kind of like Luke's gospel very much plays into the Gentile believers are still valid members of your community. They're actually helpful. They're not trying to be rebels in the way that you think they're trying to be rebels. They're actually trying to love and care and, you know, take what Jesus teaches as a way of living. He does very clearly portray the conspiracy against Jesus. And so there's a certain level of Mark defending the faith, the Christian faith, from this is a subversive revolutionary political movement. This is a bunch of zealots from Israel trying to overthrow Rome. He's going, no, this is actually an expression of the ancient faith that is bringing life to all right now. And so there's this weird kind of mixing of genres. We're not rebels, but we are. We're not revolutionaries, but this is a revolution. There's Jesus is Lord, but we're not trying to dethrone Caesar like you think we're trying to dethrone Caesar. It's a very interesting, also speaks to the earliness of Mark, because the later political movements that come with Christianity aren't yet quite so visible, I think.
Yeah. And it's like the very start of that kind of apologist genre where he's defending the faith a little bit, but not enough where you'd think, oh, that's an explicitly apologist piece of literature.
Yeah, that exactly.
We're
yeah.
used to from a little bit later.
Yeah, there's very much the intention of Mark trying to capture who Jesus was, his identity, and because of that, make who Jesus was as the Son of God and the Son of Man accessible to everyone, particularly Gentiles. That's a really big purpose, I think, which plays into that Roman audience. And like I said earlier, helping people who are potentially facing persecution within that first century kind of context is really important. But there's this idea that Mark is trying to explain the mystery of God's kingdom breaking in and introducing the concept of the suffering servant and the cross being central to that, because the passion narrative, the crucifixion, is pretty much half the book.
Yeah.
So that's a really big purpose that I think Mark is trying to portray, Jesus's death and possible resurrection.
Possible, because we don't really get a very good ending to the book. Well,
no,
not necessarily not a good ending, but a different ending.
Yeah. Because he doesn't mention the virgin birth as well. So there's a lot of the stuff later on that we would probably cite as proof of Jesus's divinity that isn't in Mark, but there's the demonstration of the kingdom, which comes out very clearly in Mark.
Mm. In fact, there's quite a lot of material missing from Mark when you compare it to the other Gospels. Mm. Like a lot of the famous things from, I've got a few written down here, from Matthew, Luke and John that we come to know and like associate with Jesus's ministry. There's no Good Samaritan Beatitudes, no birth story, like you said, no really explicit resurrection story either. No. It's a bit vague. No prodigal son, no Lazarus. There's a lot of things that were the first miracles that come to mind for Jesus are missing. No water to wine.
No.
So it definitely is to the point that Mark has a Gentile audience. It's the briefest of the Gospels. He's got to get his point across about the kingdom of God, and he wants to do it quickly.
Yeah.
So his content choice and his style of writing as well definitely play into that.
Mm. I've heard it described, I might have already said this in previous episodes, but Mark is like a film script.
Yep.
It's like literally here's all the action. It's we go here, we do that, we go here, we do that.
Yeah.
This is all happening.
Fun fact, I read about that today. The word, the Greek word for immediately is used like something like 50 times or something in the book of Mark, and like 10 or something in the very first chapter, because Jesus is always doing something. It's immediately, immediately. And there's never any time to stop and teach almost. He's always moving between place to place.
Yeah, I think immediately that many times, again Jesus went here is like 30-ish times. Jesus began to do this is again about in the high 20s, like this constant.
It's
Jesus
action.
Is acting. It's as the scholars say, it's a vivid narrative.
Vivid.
Vivid is good. The Greek's not great.
No, it's not. It's not very flattering if you're a grammatician, is it?
Yes. So possibly betraying Mark's Jewish roots. He's not used to using Greek as a language.
No.
It's a little rough around the edges.
I think we talked about in the first episode the historical past of Mark's Greek, where he starts in one tense and finishes in another, kind of brings the past to life is the little nice silver lining.
Nice way of saying he's terrible at grammar.
He's terrible at it,
Well, that all very kind of nicely leads us to the theological kind of themes and emphasis and distinctives of Mark, which set it apart from the other Gospels and which help us kind of grapple with who Jesus is presented as in Mark's Gospel.
Yeah, so there's a couple of really big themes in Mark, especially when you compare it to the other Gospels and you see their big themes as well. And we talked about that a little in the first episode. So just to quickly summarize them again, you've got the kingship and sovereignty of Matthew versus the servanthood of Mark, the humanity of Luke, and then the transcendence,
yeah,
the divinity. Of John. So the servanthood theme in Mark is a huge one. And it's kind of difficult to distinguish it sometimes from the humanity we get in Luke, because to be fair, Mark has probably the most human portrait of Jesus of nearly all the Gospels. So like you said, important things about the servanthood. There's no genealogy for that very reason. Servants, you didn't really know, need to know where they came from.
Yeah.
Romans especially didn't care.
No.
And with a Roman audience, servanthood is what, like we were talking about, is very runs against the grain of their society, where everything was about making inroads and leaving your mark on the world. So it's a bit of the opposite. And the servanthood theme comes out in many of the ways that Mark portrays his narratives, particularly in the crucifixion narrative at the end as well.
And that plays into a few different expressions then. So the humanity of Jesus is really clear. We see him eating a lot. We see him walking a lot. We see him sleeping.
Like emotions.
All sorts of stuff like that. But also plays then into the mission of Jesus, because as a servant, he comes not to be served like the Romans wanted, but to serve.
It's the key verse of Mark, really.
Yeah. And he expresses that ultimately by dying on behalf of those who are apart from God, the sinners, the broken, the lost. So that comes through very clearly. But that is on the back of pretty much the rest of the gospel, setting up Jesus's mission as expressing and establishing the reign of God in his new kingdom, which comes through pretty clearly. So we get quite a bit of allusion to the Old Testament, even though it doesn't expressly quote it as much as other gospels.
And I read in a couple of places he actually misquotes as well. Yeah, I think Malachi or Micah at the start, he misquotes a bit, but at least he was trying.
Yes. Well, he tries to quote Exodus, Malachi, and Isaiah at the very start. And,
right.
Doesn't do it as eloquently as Matthew, let's say.
Yeah. He did his best, but
he did great.
Just not quite as well.
Hey, you can't knock a fella for having a crack at it.
That's true.
And
that's
now scripture, so it doesn't matter.
I really can't say that,
No,
can I?
You really can't say that. The identity of Jesus does come through as the servant, but also as Messiah, as the fulfillment of the promise of God throughout the Old Testament, but also then the Messiah becoming God's son, which weren't necessarily connected ideas in the Old Testament. So one day we'll do a series on Isaiah, because we should.
Can't wait.
It's amazing. But so we get the suffering servant of Isaiah coming through, which is particularly through the servant songs, ultimately kind of expressed in Isaiah 52 and 3, which is the pinnacle servant song. We just did a Passover with my life group and lots of Isaiah 53 coming in there. But you also, again, get the kingship of Christ, which as the expression of God as son, so playing off the messianic Davidic line, God's son as king, comes through really clearly. Probably there's like three key statements throughout Mark, which kind of take us through the movements of Mark as well. So 1:1 in Mark, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Mark 8:29, Peter confesses, you are the Christ. And then Mark 14, when the high priest interrogates Jesus, he basically accuses him of saying that he is God and the Son of God. And Jesus clearly responds to the high priest, I am.
Yeah.
And I am being a very loaded statement within Jewish culture.
Yeah, exactly.
And so we get that right through. So beginning, middle, and end, Jesus's expression as the Son of God and the Messiah and God's sent one is really clear.
And we get that idea of Messiah not necessarily being associated with the Son of God comes out in perhaps another key theme of the book, which is the disciples and the failure of the disciples, if anything.
They come across very poorly.
Yeah, and surprisingly, most of all, Peter gets a pretty bad rap considering that he and John are meant to be, you know, tight.
This is my question, and maybe because Paul didn't have someone to write on his behalf like Peter did. Paul is quite forthcoming with his shortcomings as he writes.
You know,
as he gets older, he seems to be a little more humble. Mm-hmm. And there seems to be some level of accusation against the disciples, who then become apostles, of being totally up themselves.
Absolutely.
Like, you know, there's like infighting amongst the in crowd. And so Paul kind of plays himself down. I wonder if Peter's like, hey, Mark, can you just make sure you really portray me? Yeah, Cromwell style, warts and all, you know, because people are telling me I'm up myself and I really need to tell them I wasn't perfect. You know?
Well, if anything, if that was the case, John's done a good job.
Overplayed it, yeah.
Because Peter denies Jesus several times, misunderstands a few things.
They do not get parables.
They don't get it at all.
It's like,
it's really bad. And I mean, we probably can't laugh at them too much because we're always discovering more.
This is true. This is true.
Yeah.
One of my favorite depictions of the disciples. So Jesus calms the storm. They freak out. First, they accuse him of not caring, which is funny.
That's not good.
But then he says, peace to the storm, be still, it ceases. He says to them, why are you so afraid? Do you still have no faith? Like,
that's really us.
My other favorite scene in Mark's gospel with the disciples, just not getting it, is in chapter 8, which I'll flick over there too because I want to do it justice.
Yeah, yeah.
So Jesus has been feeding the 5,000. He then feeds the 4,000. He's walked on water. It's all going on. And then he literally just finishes feeding the 4,000. They collect up all of this food. They jump in the boat and then they're on their way across the Sea of Galilee. And it says in chapter 8, verse 14, now they had forgotten to bring bread. We just had the miracle of feeding the 4,000. Just remember that. They've forgotten to bring bread and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. So they have some bread, just not much bread. And Jesus cautioned them saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus says, aware of this, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not perceive or understand?
These guys, man.
Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? And then he starts to talk about, I broke five loaves to feed 5,000 and how many baskets were left over? And they're like, 12?
Oh, 12
when we
disciples.
Had seven loaves of bread and there was 4,000 people to feed, how many baskets did you pick up? Seven. And then Jesus says, do you not yet understand? And the response of Mark? And so they came to Bethsaida.
So it's like, let's just skip over that bit real quick.
It's like, we didn't bring bread. Okay. He's talking about the leaven of Herod. And is he talking about bread again? I don't understand. And Jesus is like, now I'm going to spell it out for you plainly. And they're like, we don't get it.
Still don't get it.
it's infamous, it's hilarious.
Lunchbox incident.
It's absolutely hilarious.
I can't believe it.
We don't know what you're talking about.
That's perhaps the perfect example of this key theme that runs through Mark, because the disciples consistently fail to understand Jesus's teaching, which then gives Jesus another opportunity to reinforce that teaching or to offer a new teaching. And that particularly happens with Peter denying Jesus at the end. Each time is an opportunity for Jesus to give another insight or a remark. But yes, the shortcomings of the disciples are certainly a theme of the gospel.
And I think if you only had Mark's gospel, you would read it and you go, I think Jesus is being a little tough on these guys.
Yeah.
Like, because there's no Sermon on the Mount.
No.
There's no explanation. There's none of the behind-the-scenes dialogue. So, you know, very rarely do we get Jesus interpreting anything, explaining anything. It is in there, but it's definitely quite rare.
Yeah.
And so you'd be reading, it's like, wow, he expects them to know a lot. But then when you read Matthew and Luke particularly, and then John's gospel with the seven different discourses, you know, like, oh, Jesus spent a lot of time teaching.
Yeah.
He spent a lot of time explaining.
You should know
a little
bit.
On this.
Yeah.
Like, definitely. If I was putting them in order, I'd put Mark before Matthew's gospel because you'd be like, why is he being so mean to these guys?
The upskilling of the disciples. Yeah.
They're getting smarter as we go further through.
And like we talked about in the first episode, there is somewhat of an element of Matthew and Luke making amends for the disciples' misunderstanding in Mark to some degree. There's a little bit of extra context given or...
Don't be too hard on these guys.
So they get a better rap in the other gospels.
Yeah. And I can understand why people think they were very young.
Yeah.
Because you get the impression, like, I have teenagers in my house. And sometimes I feel like, if those disciples were teenagers at the time where Jesus was discipling them, I get it. He's like, I told you to go pick this stuff up. Is that our own bread? No. Just put that down before you hurt yourself, please. But anyway, we shouldn't be mean because every time
We've all been there.
Yeah, that's us. So the response to Jesus is actually one of the key themes that Mark brings out, because there's this weird tension that seems to come through, is that regularly people are asking questions about Jesus' identity. And Jesus often responds with questions, who do you say that I am? So there's this constant concern around identity counterbalanced with Jesus seeming to want to keep his identity secret.
Yeah.
And so there's this declaration of God's kingdom being established through Jesus as the Son of God, and Jesus saying, don't tell anyone who I am. It's like, but so, doesn't that
that's kind of defeats the purpose, counterproductive? Doesn't it?
Yeah. In fact, even in Mark's gospel, we have Jesus, when he's accused of casting out demons by the power of the prince of demons, he makes it quite clear, hey, a kingdom divided against itself can't stand. So there's got to be something else going on. Otherwise, in the same idea, we're trying to hide the very thing we're trying to reveal.
Yeah.
That doesn't make sense. So that's quite a complex moment, but I think it actually plays into kind of the biggest thing for me out of Mark, and credit to the Bible Project for giving me better words for it, is Mark's whole gospel seems to be targeted around asking the reader the question, who do you personally say Jesus is? So we see on the mouth of so many people in so many scenes, this confusion or question about the identity of Christ, ultimately expressed most succinctly by a Gentile, the centurion.
Yep.
Surely this man is the Son of God. But it leaves us with the question, who do you say Jesus is?
Yeah, and that question that we're given is really highlighted because there's actually quite a few answers provided in the gospel itself, apart from the centurion. And like in hindsight, we can read the words of Jesus and go, yes, with the context of the rest of the Bible, that's, we understand that. But the theme of secrecy and like the ambiguity around Jesus' identity in the gospel itself really gives you the question to say, oh, yes, who do I say you are? Because let alone the messianic secret, which comes out, I might let you talk about that. But also, there's just ambiguity. Okay, we won't talk about that. Or there's also just ambiguity. There's ambiguity and secrecy, even in like Mark's presentation of events. There's often times where Jesus only takes three disciples with him.
Right,
Peter, James, and John get privileged, secretive access to the Transfiguration, a couple of other things that I'm forgetting now. But
he does seem to play favorites.
He does play favorites, and there's that element of secrecy. Mark's writing, he leaves a lot of dead ends. He just stops abruptly and goes,
like Jesus asking, do you understand?
And exactly.
Doesn't mention it again.
And doesn't give an answer to it, or he just comes to the end of a story and you'd expect a bit more like the other gospels, but it just ends there. And it's up to the reader to decide, what do I think about that? And it's probably best expressed at the, after the crucifixion, where Mark's gospel suddenly ends with the two women come and find his tomb missing. And then they run off terrified because they see an angel, and that's where it ends. And you're like, well, it might not end.
Well,
like
let's talk about the ending. Let's take the moment to talk about the ending. So if you've read Mark's gospel before, and I'm assuming that some of you listening probably have, there's in my Bible, in every Bible, even in my Greek New Testament, there's an ending and then there's an extra ending. So I think growing up, it confused me, but I think for my kids, it makes sense. It's kind of like there's an end credit scene.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
It's like, you know, if you're watching any of the MCU movies, there's always an end credit scene. At the time of recording, Falcon and the Winter Soldier is what's being played on high rotation in my house. And the most recent episode finally had an end credit scene.
Wow.
We've been waiting like
and you've got to watch through every single credits to get there too.
Yes, it's long. But anyway, so the I digress. I should not liken the Gospels to Marvel movies, but a lot of people find a lot of gospel truth. In
I was going to say.
It's the whole thing. Anyway, that's another discussion
another
for
episode.
Another day. Yeah, the gospel according to Marvel. And so, yes, as you said, Mark 16, verse 8, and they, the women, went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid.
And that's it.
And then my gospel says, my Bible says, some of the earliest manuscripts do not include the next section.
And by some, we mean nearly all of the early Greek manuscripts did not include the next section.
Because then it goes on to talk about his appearance to Mary, the Magdalene, and then to two disciples, which sounds just like Luke's gospel, the road to Emmaus.
Yeah.
And then the Great Commission gets put on the end. And it's a very interesting Great Commission, which has given rise to some very interesting practices in church expressions around the world. It's the bit with the snakes not biting you. And there's a whole expression of church, snake churches, which is super weird.
Yeah,
but we won't go there.
There's
today.
Some of it in the deep south. That it happens
in the States. Yeah, yeah, it's
I really read a whole paper on it. It's
me too.
Bizarre.
I watched a documentary on it. It's so weird. Anyway, but yeah. So the earliest versions of Mark's gospel ends with no resolution, an empty tomb, Jesus's words echoing in your ears. that he is the Son of God and he's going to come back from the tomb, from the dead. And we see an empty tomb and no explanation. And
it's a bit of a cliffhanger, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. And it really does, for me, emphasize the fact that Mark's gospel is asking us the question, if the tomb is empty, what do you think Jesus is doing right now?
Yeah.
Who is he? Is he the risen king or is he just a missing corpse?
Exactly.
That's the thing. Yeah.
And we're definitely not saying we should rip out the pages that include verses 9 to 20
at the end
of Mark. It's definitely all still correct scripture in the sense that we definitely find the same stories in Matthew and Luke.
Yep.
We know that Jesus rose from the dead, but it's just that Mark probably didn't include this bit in his gospel.
And there's various theories. One, he didn't stylistically want to include it. Others are that the scroll wasn't quite long enough. It's short enough to it's short enough to fit on a single manuscript scroll.
Yeah.
And the end bit probably didn't, so they didn't include an ending because it wasn't long enough, or the ending was accidentally removed from the earliest versions because of the length of things, all sorts of stuff like that. Look, a lot of it doesn't tend to hold water. I feel like it's probably
a
best attributed to
choice,
and then a later scribal edition from the traditional versions of the story of Jesus.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's the crazy ending bit. So the ending that is added on does have strong traditions and witness. So where it is existent, it's pretty consistently existent.
Yeah.
There is also a shorter extra ending of Mark. Did you know that?
I did not. In added onto this one or a shorter version of the ending
we
have?
There's two endings.
Oh,
a short
okay.
extra ending and a long extra ending, which is fascinating.
Yeah.
But the long extra ending is the one with all of the strongest support.
So yeah.
We take the
take that one.
We take the actual ending as the most helpful one to get our heads around Mark. We take the longer extra ending as the most reliable early witness post Mark's stylistic ending.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Hopefully you
everyone's
got that.
Totally confused right now. Anyway, so that's the weird ending of Mark. It's one of those kind of sometimes you see the seams show in the fact that you were reminded that these are people's literary depictions of what God has revealed to them. And so humans wrote it under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah.
It's like in John's gospel, there's a few bits where, like, particularly in the Last Supper discourse, where he says, "Let us go from here." And then they don't go. He just continues to talk.
Yeah.
And so it's like, oh, what happened there?
Didn't have an eraser on hand or something.
Yeah. Like, oh, no, I've gone early. they're going to freak out when they read this in 2,000 years. So the other thing about Mark is there are some distinctives, which we kind of picked up on, but there's a few things that are probably worth just kind of mentioning as we move into the structure of Mark and helping us read Mark. So we've said that it's more action than teaching. That's one of the distinctives
Definitely.
Of Mark.
Yep.
There's a lot of eyewitness sources in there. We've got a lot of specific incidents that seem to be depicted by people who are there. So again, speaks to Peter being heavily involved in giving Mark this information. There's quite frank depiction of everyone. Like, there's no hiding the shortcomings.
It's very honest,
particularly Jesus' enemies and the response of Jesus' enemies to him. It's very clear. Event happens. Things that you think would really cause disruption. So particularly in chapter 3, I noticed this. Jesus breaks the Sabbath by eating the wheat. Everyone notices. He doesn't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
Then Jesus heals a man on the Sabbath. They notice. Then they say something. They walk away. They go, "We're going to plot to kill this guy."
Big problem with that one.
Bang. Yeah. You know, there it is. Which comes into the messianic secret idea, which is a distinctive of Mark, in that the implication seems to be that Jesus didn't want to reduce his ministry to one specific expression, particularly a healing ministry. He didn't want people to get obsessed with the physical healing alone, apart from the inbreaking kingdom. But there's also the secret around they didn't want him to be made a political king and miss the inbreaking kingdom of God affecting physical bodies.
Mm,
and so he seems to be playing these things like, keep it on the down low right now because more's happening than you realize.
Mm.
And so he's asking each person to consider who he is without playing his full hand at every moment. So I think that's kind of the succinctest way to wrap up the messianic secret.
Yeah, that's a good way to summarize it.
Mm. He's big on the servant thing. He's big on the amazement of what happens when God's kingdom breaks in. But, and this plays into the structure, is where we're going to go next, is that it seems to be like it's a story of Jesus's crucifixion with a long intro.
Yeah, I read that as well.
It's all about moving towards the cross.
The passion narrative is something like half of the book almost. Mm. And everything depending before on where you start the passion narrative. Yeah. And everything before that is really important in setting it up. The only other thing I'd say is a distinctive of Mark, and this is a very literary one, and I'm not sure how much it appears in the other Gospels, but certainly something when we talk about the structure and we think about how we read Mark, I thought of something I came across that was helpful to keep in mind. There's four occasions Mark uses quite frequently, considering the size of the Gospel, a literary technique called intercalation, which I had never heard of before, but once I read what it was, I knew what it was. So you might as well.
Okay, yeah.
It's when you wrap one story around another story to make a nice little story sandwich, like a literary sandwich.
Yeah. Almost like a chiastic structure.
Yes, a bit like a chiastic structure. And the purpose of it is for when we read it in scripture to compare the two stories and realize that that they feed into each other and that we should use one story to help interpret the other one.
Okay. So As a for instance,
it happens four times in Mark. The best one I found was the fig tree. Which is a classic one because everyone gets to the fig tree passage and goes, well, what? That was a bit needless, Jesus. It's just an innocent fig tree. You didn't really have to do that, did you? But if you read it properly, I'll do the quick verse summary for you. So Jesus curses a fig tree, chapter 11, verse 12 to 14.
Yep.
He then takes a break from the fig tree for a second.
He does.
To talk about the temple.
And what does he do in the temple?
He calls it a den of robbers and he curses it.
he and destines cleans it out.
Cleans it out. Yep. It's destined for doom. Mm-hmm. But then suddenly, verse 20, he's back to the fig tree again.
Yep.
And he talks about how the fig tree dies. It withers and dies. So he's wrapped the story of the temple inside the story of the fig tree. And so we're not meant to read the stories individually. We're meant to go ahead and read it we're meant to read the temple story through the lens of the fig tree not producing fruit and then dying as a result, with the implication being the temple in the middle. It's not producing the kingdom fruit.
That's right.
It's destined for destruction. Which, I mean, physically in 70 AD did happen.
Happens, yeah.
So, let alone on a spiritual level. So, if you're reading through and you find that, feel free to keep that in mind as you read.
That's very helpful. I have noticed that. And that does shed light on it. I wonder, even in that passage, so chapter 11, either side of the fig tree is the triumphal entry and then the high priest rejection of Jesus.
Yeah.
And so it's not necessarily like it's still connected again. Yeah. So you get this chiastic structure again where the outside leads towards the middle. What's at the center is actually
the most important usually. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's the temple. Yeah.
And which is about what's at the center of people's faith, what's at the center of people's belief, and what's the fruit that it keeps. Yeah, interesting.
Which comes back to all the crazy parallels with the structure of the temple itself and the tabernacle, about all the symmetry and stuff being at the middle of that. And
so interesting.
We can't go into that,
again,
but
another rabbit warren.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, so good. Well, okay, so let's talk about the structure if we've jumped in.
Yeah.
And the fact that there's some of these little kind of envelopes or parcels or sandwiches of content, that's super helpful to look out for. Mm. So if we see themes with something in between it, let's try and understand what's in between by what's on the outside.
They can be on a micro level like that with the verses, or on a macro level, like closer to when, at the start of the book, this happens and it's bookended at the end of the book like that as well.
Yeah, true. Like I was saying before with the Son of God revelations.
Yep. Absolutely. So look out for them.
Very cool. Okay. So if we look at the structure, let's look at the structure and then we'll take a short break and we'll jump into a quick run through a little closer.
Yep.
The structure is kind of three movements really.
Yes.
Everyone seems to suggest three movements. Some say two, but most people say three.
It's two that can be divided into three. So, yeah.
But the breakpoint always seems to be chapter 8, verse 30.
Yeah.
So, there's a big line drawn at chapter 8, verse 30.
Yeah. Clear cut there.
Yeah. And so, the first part is kind of, apart from a very short introduction, maybe 13 verses, we have kind of Jesus's first ministry session up north.
Yeah.
In Galilee.
In Galilee.
Yeah.
So the setting for the first half's all in Galilee. And a ministry session's a pretty good way to describe it, really,
because
we're full of miracles. Yep. We've even got a bit of teaching, some parables.
The disciples.
Disciples.
Yep.
Action.
Yep.
All happens.
We get that really interesting scene where Jesus is rejected at Nazareth. We'll come to that. The second part starts in chapter 8, verse 31. And can go all the way to the end because that's when he starts to begin his journey to Jerusalem.
Yep.
But it's kind of more helpful to break it up to include chapter 8, 30 to 10, chapter 10, because that's what we kind of get another question about Jesus's identity and kind of another expression of Jesus' identity. And so it's kind of the middle movement that looks at his kind of Judean ministry. Mm-hmm. So he's gone, his northern ministry, his southern ministry, and then from chapter 11 we get his Jerusalem ministry.
Yeah,
which is kind of takes us through the crucifixion and the resurrection and the empty tomb and what happens next. And so you kind of get those, you get up north, down south in Jerusalem, the three kind of big movements.
It's quite interesting when you look at it as a whole, because in the three movements, the first and the last movements are obviously the biggest.
Mm.
And that middle movement, the Judean ministry, I've also heard it described as like the transition ministry, the on the way, the journey ministry.
Yeah.
As he makes his way through Judea into Jerusalem.
Yeah.
So when you look at it, you get those big sections of the first, the who is Jesus in the Galilee section, mm-hmm. and then the you get all the same questions repeating in the different regions and the transition. I find it interesting how the transition ministry is just that it's reflected on a literary standpoint as well. It's just the quick 2-3 chapters in the middle with a couple of key events like the Transfiguration.
Pretty
and then suddenly
event.
You're back into Jerusalem and like you get this big triumphal return or entry into Jerusalem as the final big literary section. It's fascinating.
Mm, yeah, and then we get our weird ending, and then that's the structure.
And then it's done, yep.
Mm. Okay, so we get the quick intro with some quotes or misquotes from the Old Testament.
Yep.
And then we get pretty much, which introduces John, who we get a little bit of information about John in the Gospel of Mark. We get the horrible scene with the head on a platter, which is horrific, but also then has become a colloquialism. Like, you know, every time we hear it, it comes from this. But we get the baptism of Jesus as the first big event. We get the declaration in chapter 1, verse 14 and 15. After John was arrested, Jesus came into Galilee proclaiming the gospel of God and saying, "The time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent and believe in the gospel." And that kind of sets the scene really for what's going to happen, the kingdom breaking in. So we get disciples called, we get deliverances, we get healing. He starts to preach. That's kind of the whole first chapter. Boom. That all happens in one chapter.
I know. It's like, so much.
Dang,
You'd
so
think
much.
We're describing half the gospel in that, but it's really just the first chapter.
That's the first chapter. And then it slows down a little bit. And this is what I noticed as I read. It slows down. It goes quick, slows down, goes quick, slows down. So it slows down for a couple of big stories which start to describe Jesus' nature. We get the healing of the paralyzed man.
Yep.
We get the calling of Levi, who's unclean and cast out and no one likes him. We get some questions about fasting and the Sabbath, and then a few more healings, and the crowd starts to gather. Chapter 3, with the crowd starts coming around. It starts becoming problematic. Jesus is getting kind of overcrowded everywhere he goes.
Yep. We get series of miracles then, stilling the storm, your famous legion of demons into the herd of pigs and running off the edge of a cliff into the
Which
water
is a
or whatever.
Really long story
it
compared
is.
To everything else.
Yeah.
If you and this is helpful where you see the headings in your Bible, because you can kind of really start to see, oh, this is a long section. There's something important going on here.
That's a good way to put it actually. Whenever there's a nice long story, read it extra closely. It's important to mark.
So that chapter 5 section is really interesting because it's just two stories.
Yeah.
It's the demoniac at the Gerasenes, and it's Jairus' daughter and the woman with the flow of blood.
Which is another intercalation.
Is it intercalation?
Intercalation, yeah.
Yeah, I like that. I will never remember to say it,
but
it's a good word. It's a good word. And so, yeah, we get some really interesting stories there. And so, yeah, start to look at those. But then we start to find the resistance against Jesus starting to really spark up. So chapter 6, we get the fairly famous scene at Nazareth where people don't believe he is who he is.
In his own town. Oh,
yeah. It's terrible. It says in chapter 6, verse 5, and he could do no mighty work there in Nazareth except that he laid his hands on a few sick people and healed them. And he marveled because of their unbelief.
Which goes a little bit back as well to the humanity of Jesus in this book in that he definitely can do miracles as God, right? But here, he doesn't do miracles. He doesn't perform miracles partly
because
due to the lack of faith. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting though that he does heal people.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's I've heard it said by some pastors and preachers that, you know, you get a few people get healed in a service and like, wow, we're almost at the level of Nazareth, the people known for their unbelief. So, you know, it's oh yeah, maybe. Anyway, that's a little pastoral insight on top of the biblical exegesis. So then we get into the 12 being sent out, which is unpacked a lot more in the other Gospels.
Yeah.
We get the death of John the Baptist, which is quite a long section.
Yeah, it's a bit of a throwback as well.
And very historically kind of involved. We get all sorts of different people who we don't hear about in any depth in the other Gospels. So we get Herod, we get Herodias, which is an awkward family relation, and there's some untoward sexual activity happening there, which is not okay.
It's very odd.
It's all bad. And then John is beheaded, which is horrific, because of someone's whim, because John was basically calling out unlawful practices and sinful behaviors, and they didn't like it. So Herod was too afraid to get rid of him. And so there was this very complicated, almost, and this isn't, I don't know if this is any connection. I didn't read it in any commentary, but it felt very much like something out of Esther one of the Old Testament scenes where the kind of irrevocable laws are made and people have to stick to it, and something happens because they've made an unwitting commitment to something they didn't understand, which I think plays again into Mark's kind of bigger picture of what's happening behind the scenes that people don't understand.
And this John the Baptist story is another one of those literary sandwiches, which is interesting because it's a bigger one. It's almost the whole chapter where you get the sending out of the disciples. Then you suddenly get this break in the chronology. We disrupt the timeline, go back to John the Baptist's execution, basically. And then at the end, afterwards, you get the continuation of like the sending out of the disciples, or I can't remember the exact context of it, but it's kind of wrapped around the story of John the Baptist to show that it's not going to be easy work.
Yeah.
You're being sent out. Also, by the way, your mate John the Baptist, he just got his head cut off. Yep. So,
it's
persecution inbound.
And you see the disciples having to step up because you get the feeding of the 5,000, which is very interesting because Jesus basically tells them to do it.
Yeah.
Go and feed these people. And like,
it's no small ask, is it?
We can't. He's like, well, here's how you do it.
Yeah.
And he does this miracle, amazing miracle. Then he walks on water, which is one of the most bizarre scenes. And I want to just take a moment to read out because I like, what is going on? Like,
it is odd.
It's so odd. It says, this is after the feeding of the 5,000 males. So there's more than 5,000, probably up to 15,000 people getting fed from these two loaves and fishes and five fishes. There's 12 baskets of food gathered up. Immediately he makes his disciples get into the boat, verse 45 of chapter 6, and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. After he had taken leave of them, he went up to the mountain to pray. So there on the sea, remember, a good number of them fishermen.
Mm-hmm.
This is familiar territory for them.
They're used to the water.
He then climbs a mountain to pray, take some time. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea and Jesus was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully. So either they'd gone not very far or Jesus had pretty good eyesight, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. He meant to pass them by.
Oops.
Like, what is that?
He just wanted to check up on them, see how they were doing.
Yeah, you guys are doing it tough. I'm going to keep going. Right? Like, I was like, Mark, why?
What were you thinking?
Tell me why. But when they saw Jesus walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost. And they cried out, as you would. For they all saw him and they were terrified.
I like how he had to include that.
I don't know if that has some kind of contextual meaning for them at the time. And I don't know. It's just like, what is going on? This is weird. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. It's
like, hang on a sec.
What? So walking on water is connected to the loaves. They think it's a ghost. He wasn't going to even stop, and their hearts are hardened. Like,
yeah, I think that the weirdest part is that, like, he wasn't even going to stop, that he meant to pass them by.
It's like, kind of what? Like, I stop and think about that passage, and it's literally like tumbleweeds.
Yeah.
Like, I don't even know what to do now.
Oh, no, they're scared. I better do something now. Like,
and it's got something to do with the loaves. So, what?
Okay.
What is with Mark and bread?
Yeah,
that's
true.
What I want to know. Mm. Anyway. So Jesus heals some more. We get this whole kind of one of the few teachings of Jesus in Mark's Gospels in chapter 7, where he teaches on kind of tradition, Jewish tradition and ritual, which was washing, ritual washings, and how that made people clean or not. And so there was this whole discussion with the Pharisees and other scribes who had come from Jerusalem to kind of find out what was going on. I found it interesting too. This is something that caught my attention as we went through. In chapter 7, while he's teaching on washings and what makes you clean or unclean, he kind of calls out to everyone who's listening, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that, by going into him, can defile him." Right? So he's resetting some things here. But the things that come out of a person are what defile him. And most of us will go, yes, so that's Jesus's changing up of, it's not the outside in, it's the heart that actually becomes issue. Yeah. And we see this in the other Gospels. You know, you have heard it said, if you kill someone, you know, if you look at someone with hate in your heart,
you're
guilty of murder. But it says this, he goes in the house, he starts to explain it and says, you know, don't you understand that whatever goes into a person can't defile him because it gets passed through his body and expelled. It doesn't enter into his heart, but his stomach, Jesus has a good understanding of physiology, and is expelled from him. And this is what it says in verse 19. Thus he declared all foods clean. And I'm like, oh, I always thought it was in Acts chapter 10 when Peter has his dream about bacon.
And you get good old Cornelius and stuff.
Yeah, but Jesus had already preempted this in Mark's gospel. I totally missed that. I'd forgotten entirely that that happened there. So like, that's a little Easter egg there that I'd forgotten entirely. So
that's true, actually. Yeah, I hadn't noticed that.
Did Jesus stick to the dietary laws or not?
I don't know.
It doesn't really matter.
Before his crucifixion.
Probably not. Probably did before his crucifixion.
Yeah.
But yeah. Anyway, had a bacon double cheeseburger on Resurrection Sunday. And then we get a really interesting, and this probably isn't, I don't know if this is another one of your interlocation.
Maybe it could be. I don't know.
But we get this conversation about what defiles you and what doesn't. Then we get a really interesting moment with the Syrophoenician woman who kind of, Jesus says, I'm not here. I'm not going to heal you. And she goes, no, come on, you got to. And he does, once she identifies the fact that he's come to set Israel straight and bring Israel back into the kingdom of God, which is a very interesting moment, which kind of gets to the intention of Jesus in Mark's gospel, which is very much focused on his messianic work.
Mm.
Yeah.
And so it hinted his humanity as well in the sense that he, you know,
change the
he's influenced by what the woman says, and he changes his mind almost.
Kind of makes me think of John chapter 2 with the turning water into wine at the wedding.
That's true. Like,
hey, it's not my time yet.
I'm not going to do it, Mom. I'm not going to do it.
I told you. Don't make me do it. So then he heals a deaf man. He feeds the 4,000. We get the interesting request for a sign. We get the poor old disciples going, is he talking about bread? We don't understand. Which comes to the end of that kind of first section with Peter's confession. Peter says in chapter 8, verse 29, and in response to Jesus's question, who do you say I am? Peter answers, you are the Christ. And so Jesus kind of didn't seem to want to let everyone know. He wanted people to have revelation from the Father about who he was. Hmm. And then we get the pivot point and we start the journey to Jerusalem in chapter 8, verse 31.
Yep. So that middle section, the second half of chapter 8 and 9 and 10 is kind of that, or up to 10. Is that little journey to Jerusalem through Judea. So the big thing here is the transfiguration. Yeah. So we get Elijah and Moses appearing on the mountain. A whole discussion of the transfiguration probably warrants another location, but you get representing the prophet and the law, or the two people who in the Old Testament who didn't have natural deaths, they both had encounters with the presence on Mount Sinai.
Yep.
And so they're not the ambiguity around the mountain's name in Mark is probably a hint that it's meant to represent Mount Sinai in the sense Jesus is the presence of God, and that the transfiguration is a recapitulation of the theophanies of the Old Testament.
Ooh, there you go.
So the privileged three who get to witness it get again, to go, is this who Jesus is? He's now the presence of God as well. Ooh. So very interesting.
But that does seem to be the core, kind of the central kind of anchor point of this middle section of this pivot. So then Jesus does some more healing ministry. He heals a boy with an unclean spirit. So there's deliverance ministry happening. There's the kingdom of light breaking into the kingdom of darkness. Jesus starts to speak further into what's coming now. So chapter 9, verse 30, he starts to speak about the fact that he's going to be handed over to the authorities, that he's going to be killed, and after 3 days he's going to rise. But in verse 32, they did not understand the saying and were afraid to ask him. Well,
bit of a recurrent theme there.
Yeah. So we get the awkward conversation about which of the disciples is the greatest, and Jesus diffuses it by saying, hey, look, everyone on our side is on our side. If they're doing things in my name, they're on our team. Everyone chill out. He starts to teach a little bit more at the end of chapter 9 into 10.
It's a bit of teaching here.
Yeah, which is good. Which, again, still quite short and quite sparse comparatively.
Yeah.
We get the cost of discipleship. So come as a child, you have to get rid of your riches. You're going to have to die. He starts to speak of his death again. We finally get to chapter 11, really, is where we need to kind of pick up as we just start to draw this episode to a close. We get the passion narrative begin in chapter 11 with the triumphal entry, which, having just celebrated Easter here when we're at the time of initial recording, this is all kind of very familiar to us. We've kind of gone through this, but we get our Mark and sandwich.
A Mark and sandwich of the fig tree, yeah.
Yes. It's a fig sandwich. So, yeah, we've already talked about Jesus cleansing the temple, Jesus being challenged. We get some parables,
yeah,
which is helpful here. Jesus, but it's a parable specifically about Jesus being rejected in his first incarnation and his first presentation, with a promise that at his second he will be recognized for who he is.
Yep.
The stone that the builders rejected has become the cornerstone. We get this real clear, there's a rejection and then there's an acceptance and a new standard set because of the second opportunity. Mm-hmm. So again, no idea what's going on. Disciples, it's like, I think he's talking to you.
You know? Yeah, I hope so.
Yep. Some interesting stuff with the, there's a lot of interactions with the power and the forces that are present in Jerusalem at this point. So we get Jesus's interaction with the Romans and how believers should interact with Rome about paying taxes. There's interaction with the Jewish leadership. So who are the Sadducees and what do they believe? That all starts to come out. And really then them testing Jesus about his teaching. So what do you believe about the resurrection? What do you believe about the commands of the Torah? What are the most important commands?
Give him a bit of a test and they don't realize he is the answer.
Yeah. Check me out. Right before the crucifixion, we do get Jesus connecting now himself with the line of David, which is a really important moment, I think, in Mark's gospel in chapter 12, verse 35. So he's actually saying, he's quoting Psalm 2, I think it is, isn't it? The Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand. Or is it Psalm 8?
Couldn't tell you. Can't remember.
Oh, Psalm 110. I was way off. I should have remembered. It's the one that Mike Bird was talking about.
2 plus 8 quoted. Is 10, 110.
Yeah, great. 100%.
You forget.
So, and that really takes us quite close to some prophetic declarations in chapter 13 where he starts to kind of throw it forward a bit. And this is kind of as close as we get in Mark's gospel. If you remember back at the start of this episode, there's not a lot pointing to the destruction of the temple. This is kind of the only spot we get it, which is also riffing off, if you remember back to our first episode, the fact that there had been temple kind of temple breaches, temple defilement prior to Jesus's life. So in the Maccabean period, in the intertestamental period, there had been a time where the Romans had come in, they had sacrificed pigs on the altar and put up statues of Zeus in the middle of the actual Jewish temple, which is so offensive. And so the Maccabeans kind of, there was a big revolt and they kicked the Romans out and it was, oh, it's the golden age of Israel. Didn't stick. The Romans came back. It was very awkward. There is a play on this. And so Jesus, I think, is very much tapping into what has happened in the past. Mm. And so that's really important. And then we get the fig tree back again at the end of chapter 13 before I get in my Bible a beautiful illustration of the temple.
Oh, wow, you do. That's in color and everything. Amazing.
Yeah. And then we get really the last, from chapter 14, 15, we get the crucifixion moment, which is the night before and then the day of.
Yeah, so Jesus has the Last Supper with his disciples, and there's, probably don't have time to go into it, there's a lot of new meaning given to the Passover symbols as well, with the bread and the wine, and then obviously Jesus' arrest, trial, and then subsequent crucifixion. And then the big moment that we've talked about is at the crucifixion. It's of the accounts of the crucifixion, it's one of the briefest. I think the only words Jesus speaks in Mark on the crucifixion is, my God, why have you forsaken me?
Mm.
But we do get the Roman centurion, the Roman soldier, saying, surely this was the Son of God, which is the big moment in the gospel after all of the misunderstanding of the disciples and the questions being posed to us on who do you say that Jesus is, we get like one definitive answer at the end of the gospel with the Roman soldier saying this was the Son of God.
Which is really like, I feel like it's actually the highest point of Mark's gospel. It's like it's all been leading to that point. And we simply get after that, he's buried, he seems to be resurrected, and the tomb is empty.
Yeah.
And that's really it. So it's like, it's quite anticlimactic after that. The resurrection is almost a non-event. It's just the stone's rolled back. There's some angels there saying, he's gone. What do you do?
In the other gospels, the resurrection's the big glorious climax to the gospels.
There's the garden encounter. There's the, you know, Jesus revealing himself to the disciples, to Mary. There's the breakfast on the beach. There's the appearing to the disciples for, you know, 40 days. None of that.
And you get none of it in Mark. No. And I would like to offer an alternative high point just for the sake that we can have more than one.
Can we?
Maybe. Keep going. I like to think when you zoom out, I mean, remember you asked the question, who is Jesus to you? It's personal.
Yeah.
This is personal.
Okay, Joe? Fair enough. Okay. I'll let you take it.
When you zoom out, I love to see in these three acts, so you got chapters 1 to 8, chapters 8 to 10, and then 11 to 16. Each of them has a little defining moment that I found that I thought was really important for each of the chapters. So in the first one, you've got the baptism of Jesus, which essentially replaces his birth story in the sense that he comes out of the water and then the father says, this is my son who I dearly love. So,
which riffs off kind of John 3, you know, you've got to be born of the Spirit.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So it's somewhat of a birth story, but it's like the really important moment of the first act. And then I like to think the high point's in the very middle of the gospel so we can keep a nice chiastic structure. Oh,
fair enough.
I like
the Mark and sandwich.
Yeah, the Mark and sandwich. I like to think that the transfiguration is one of the high points.
Yeah,
perhaps physically because Mark describes it as on a really tall mountain. And it's the eminence and the significance of Jesus appearing as the presence and the manifestation of God. And then the Roman centurion, I agree, can be conceived as a high point. But like you said, there's also a bit of an anticlimax at the end of the book where what happens? Like the crucifixion is that last big element of the third act. But then after that, it sort of just fades out and you're left, oh, that was very abrupt.
Yeah.
I was expecting something more. Yeah.
I think I underestimate Mark's because of the traditionally recognized poor Greek and almost the simplistic presentation. It's just action. It's very little teaching. We almost underplay it in the fact that Mark is very clever to really shift it at the very last moment. And when we're expecting the disciples to stand up and go, this is the Son of God, he puts the right words in the wrong mouth.
Yeah, in the wrong mouth.
Changes everything. Yeah. And really, if you didn't have any other gospel, it would launch really nicely into Acts and the Gentile mission because there's almost a bait and switch. We're expecting the Jewish leadership to go, oh, we know who he is now, and the Gentiles say it instead. And all of a sudden, the stakes change entirely at the end of Mark's gospel and everything is suddenly left up in the air. And it's like, well hang on, Jesus is for everyone?
Yeah, it's almost like all the disciples are the main characters throughout the whole gospel, and then suddenly like the reader appears as the character in the Roman soldier. Like the Roman Christian audience becomes the character at the end of the book that answers the question, now it's my turn to say, who is Jesus? And it's generalized to Jesus is for everyone, and yes, he's the Son of God.
So good. Oh, Mark's gospel, great. I've just really enjoyed taking the time to jump back into this. And so hopefully as you've heard us talk about Mark's gospel, you've kind of, it's reignited a passion and interest for you. If you haven't read it, sit and read it. It will probably take you about 2 hours, I think.
It's not long.
At a push to read it. Maybe three, but less. If you've got one of those apps that can play the audio version, it'll take you very little time to listen to it. It's really, it's definitely a pleasure to listen to. And it, for me, it reignited my interest in the kind of the vitality of Jesus's ministry and what that even can look like for us today. So yeah, hopefully you get to read it. Hopefully you'll take the time to read it over the next few weeks before we jump into Matthew next. We should probably do Matthew next.
Yes.
I would prefer to go to John because it's my favorite.
John is my favorite
too. We'll do Matthew and Luke obediently.
And we have to leave John to the end.
We'll do John last because he's by far the best.
It is. I agree.
Yeah. Anyway, that's totally biased.
The philosophers in us.
Yeah. The kind of guy who looks up, you know, lectures on Kierkegaard on the internet. Yeah. It's horrific. So if you stuck with it this long, we've lost you just now. But before anything else, thank you, Alex.
No worries. Pleasure.
Always great to have the chance just to stop and talk about the Bible. How good is the Bible?
Amazing.
And hopefully you've been blessed. Why not like and share and do all the other stuff you should do when you hear a podcast you enjoy? We appreciate you sticking with us. We're going to be back next episode with another episode in our series on the Gospels, talking about Matthew. Oh, so much to talk about there. We'll see if we can knock that one down in under an hour.
It's a big one.
Not going to happen. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you next time.
Thanks for listening to this River Life podcast. Make sure you subscribe to keep up to date with all the latest content. If this podcast has raised any questions for you, contact us via church@riverlifechurch.org.au or through Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for listening.